My name is Michael McCusker. Today, July 21st, is the 150th anniversary of the First Battle of Bull Run in the American Civil War, also known as Manassas, by the creek that runs by the battle just outside D.C. and Virginia. I'd like to read a little synopsis that the AP put out on it. The Confederate shelling of Federal-held Fort Sumter in April 1861 launched the start of the Civil War. The First Battle of Bull Run, also known as the First Battle of Manassas, marked the start of the conflict in earnest. Under pressure to crush the secessionists, Union forces on July 21, 1861, initially attacked a mass of Confederate troops arrayed amid woods and farm fields of Bull Run in northern Virginia. The battle raged for hours. Union forces briefly drove Confederate foes back, but the Confederates got reinforcements. A contingent led by Thomas Stonewall Jackson stood its ground at a farmhouse hilltop, earning him his nickname. The Confederates counterattacked with cavalry charging, starting a headlong Federal retreat. Amid gunfire and chaos, panicked Union soldiers retreated to disarray to Washington. The Confederacy had scored its first major victory. And, well, it says the Boston Herald reported on July 4th that Union forces would now reorganize. After their retreat, dispatches of this morning to the Associated Press, which was in existence in those days, tell us that the services of 60,000 soldiers, previous offered the government but refused, have now been accepted and that a complete reorganization of the army is to be made. The bloody battle hinted at a long, grinding war to come. And also, the Union not only lost the battle, they ran all the way back to D.C., followed by the idiotic civilians who came out in their buggies to picnic and watch the battle as if it were a theater matinee. And that's my addition. So, in commemoration, I'd like to read something by Bruce Catton from his book Reflections on the Civil War, which actually, his reflections were transcribed and edited from tapes shortly before his death in 1978. And he was once considered the best of the Civil War historians, and he's been forgotten, perhaps by most, except many of his successors who do credit him. He was a very interesting fellow. He grew up in Ohio, I believe it was, and there were still survivors of the Civil War when he was a boy, and they used to talk to him. They were old men, and they talked about their war and left an indelible impression on him. He also was the first editor of American Heritage magazine, among many other things. He wrote a great book about civil service in World War II, of which he was a part. This one is Except by Violence. The Civil War is probably the most significant experience in our national existence. It was certainly the biggest tragedy in American history, and at the same time, probably did more to shape our future than any other event. It settled two things once and for all. In the first place, it determined that there would be one nation and not two or more between Canada and Mexico, that there would be unity in the American Republic, that the old theory of states' rights would wither to the extent that the federal government would have the power and the authority to enforce an overall national policy for the entire country. In addition, the war ended the institution of chattel slavery. That was an institution that the country could not have carried into the 20th century without suffering a crippling handicap. It is not easy to see how the institution could have been disposed of except by violence. It had been embedded, it had embedded itself too deeply, not only in the southern economy and by indirection in the northern economy as well, but in human emotions. The existence of chattel slavery made it unnecessary for people to face up to the race problem. Once slavery was destroyed, and the Civil War did destroy it, the nation was left with a piece of unfinished business. It had political unity, It had to move ahead and create a moral and emotional unity as well. Freedom is something for everybody. There could no longer be grades and distinctions in American citizenship. The Civil War ended more than a century ago. You have to remember this is coming from 1978. Nobody who had firsthand experience of what the American people were saying or thinking or feeling at that time is still alive. We take what we know of the war secondhand, and as it recedes in the distance, as we get farther and farther away from it, we tend to oversimplify it. The motives and causes, desires, hatreds and anxieties seem clearer now than they did to the people who had to live through them. We tend today to write the Civil War off rather blithely as the great war to end slavery. It was, of course, the war that did end slavery, but it did not begin that way at all. It began on a very different basis, and as a matter of fact, in the month of July 1861, after the war had gotten well started and both sides were nerving themselves for a long fight, the Congress of the United States, with Abraham Lincoln's approval, passed a resolution saying flatly that the war was not being fought to interfere with slavery in any way at all. It was being fought, said this resolution, solely to restore the Union, and it would cease when the people who were trying to break up the Union stopped fighting. At the same time, the Southern people were equally clear on the fact that they were not fighting to defend slavery. They were fighting for their own independence. They made that as clear as they could through the Congress and their president over and over again. In other words, the two governments that differed on so many matters were in agreement on that one point. They were not fighting over slavery. Yet, of course, they were. The war was about slavery. Slavery had caused it. If slavery had vanished before 1861, the war simply would not have taken place. Yet most of the soldiers who entered the Union Army did not really care about slavery. For that matter, the great majority of soldiers in the Confederate Army did not come from slave-owning families, never expected to own slaves themselves, and to the very end indignantly repelled suggestions that they were fighting in defense of slavery. In the North, it needs to be emphasized that very few of the soldiers were abolitionists. The majority did not like black people, and for the most part were perfectly willing for slavery to continue. Indeed, many of the older ones rather hoped that it would, because if it ended, the black people might flood the North Country and take jobs in farms that otherwise would go to white men. So one of the great ironies of American history becomes apparent. The white folk of the United States, North and South alike, could get along with the black man as a slave much better than they could get along with him as a free person. Yet slavery in the mid-19th century was such a fragile institution that it could not survive unless it was supported by all the power of the central government, and in a civil war, that support would be withdrawn. Slavery could not conceivably survive a full-scale civil war, yet such a war was being waged to save it. The very people who wanted slavery to live were doing precisely the thing that was sure to kill it. Deeply buried in the American soul was a seemingly irradical strain of race hatred. Of, if that phrase is too strong, a vast conviction of white superiority that dominated men's minds at the very moment when they were taking a baffling and painful road that could lead only to equality. America's basic charter, the foundation for all that Americans live by, was the flat assertion that all men are created equal. Now the nation was forcing itself to see that all men, and that's in quotes, and remember, you put into parentheses, all women were not included, means what it says. Therein lies the true, eternally baffling mystery of the Civil War. It did something hardly anyone wanted done, and it changed the course of American history forever afterward. War has a way of compelling men and women to confront the realities they try to evade. The Civil War did that with the institution of slavery. Most people in the North did not want slavery to exist in their own states, but they felt very, very little desire to do anything about it in the South. Even Abraham Lincoln, who is remembered properly today as the great emancipator, did not, before the war, class himself with the abolitionists at all. He once told a Southern friend that there was only one difference between Northerners like himself and pro-slavery men in the South. Said Lincoln, "We think slavery is wrong and ought to be restricted. You think it is right and ought to be extended. That's the only difference." The war actually came about because of a very unrealistic argument. The argument over whether the federal government had the authority and the right to prohibit slavery in the territories. This was unrealistic for the simple reason that in the Western territories, Nebraska, Kansas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, slavery simply could not exist. This was not the kind of country in which you could make money running a large factory-type farm with gang labor. In New Mexico, for instance, which became part of the Union in 1848, slavery was quite legal, but at the start of the Civil War, it contained only 9 slaves. The institution of slavery simply didn't work there. Abraham Lincoln believed, and indeed stated, that the federal government did not have the authority to interfere with slavery in the states, that it was strictly a state matter. The government in Washington could do nothing about it, and he did not propose to do anything about it, on the theory that it would, sooner or later, die in those states where it already existed. However, he did take a strong stand that there should be no extension of slavery in the territories. The Southern leaders paid no attention to the pledge that the federal government would not interfere with slavery in the states. Instead, they reacted strongly against the argument that slavery should not be allowed to expand, and the whole terrible turmoil of the late 1850s, which finally led to the war, grew out of this very unrealistic argument over slavery in the territories. Slavery itself was not a simple institution. Upward of 4 million black people were held in servitude, most of them as field hands, a sort of gang labor reserve. They had no liberties. What they got in the way of clothing, food, and housing depended entirely upon either the benevolence or neglect of the people who owned them. They were an indigestible lump, and they endured their lives as slaves as best they could. Indeed, they were a very peace-loving people. They were not vengeful. They remained so quiet, as a matter of fact, that a great many people in both sections of the country took it for granted that they were more or less content with their lot. Now and then, to be sure, the curtain would be drawn aside, and a glimpse of the truth would appear. The Nat Turner Rebellion, for instance, long before the Civil War, was a grim example of the hatreds and passions that lay under the surface. Another point, which probably accounts for much of their docility under slavery, is the simple fact that the more energetic, forward-looking, independent slaves were drained off by the institution of the Underground Railroad. They were the ones who ran away. They got to the northern states or all the way to Canada, taking with them the intelligence, the drive, the eagerness that might have made them leaders of a slave revolt. So for years, by and large, the slave population of the South seemed quite placid, and the people of the South, whose institutions were based on slavery, felt relatively secure. Slavery, as it existed in the South in 1860, varied a great deal from state to state. In the northern slave states, like Kentucky, Maryland, and Virginia, slavery was a fairly mild institution. The slaves were pretty well taken care of. Old Massa was kindly. They got along with him. A great many of them seemed not too unhappy with their lot. Where slavery was really hard, where it bore down on them, was in the Deep South, along the Gulf Coast, in the great cotton states. A slave in the northern belt of slave states, who was unruly and hard to get along with, and talk back to old Massa, would be threatened with, "We'll sell you down the river." And if he didn't watch his step, he was sold down the river, which meant that he got sold down to Louisiana or Mississippi or Alabama or Texas. That was where the slave worked until he dropped and was finally worked to death. That was where Simon Legree of Uncle Tom's Cabin lived. Getting sold down the river was a very real and terrible threat in those days. The people in the North were greatly influenced by Uncle Tom's Cabin and took their impression of slavery from the picture it painted of the downriver slave life, where the slave was part of a great gang labor setup, was worked from dawn to dusk, was flogged unmercifully when he misbehaved, and finally worked himself to death for no personal gain. The story of slavery and the men who had been slaves and women does not end when the Civil War ended. The most tragic part of it, I think, comes later, when the slow process of disillusionment came to the men and women who had been brought out of slavery, when they began to see that doors were still closed to them, that they were not masters of their own fate appreciably more than they had been before. There was, in short, a catch to freedom. For many, many years, for generations, America's black people tried with great patience and in a most orderly way to work their way out of the great weight of discrimination which was their heritage from the days of slavery. The problem has not yet been entirely solved. It is on the road to solution, but it will be a long process. We are still stuck with the heritage that came down to us from the Civil War, white and black alike. The Civil War proclaimed freedom and made freedom good, on paper at least. It proclaimed national unity and made that good. Ever since then, the American people have had a great commitment to themselves and to society as a whole. It is up to them, up to us, you and me and all of us, to prove that a free society like ours can be a unit and can extend freedom to all of its members. A classless society, if you like, not because all men and women are of equal ability, since, obviously, they are not, but because they are all of equal rights and all are disposed to respect one another's rights. We are dedicated to a society in which one man's fate and one woman's fate affects the fate of all the rest, in which your freedom and my freedom depend on the freedom of less fortunate people. We defend our own freedom by defending their rights, by seeing to it that they have the chance to defend theirs. That is our heritage from the Civil War. If we live up to it, and I think in the course of time we will, it will be worth everything we paid for it. The 600,000 lives that were offered up, the infinity of pain and suffering endured by people of both sides of the Civil War. What we have today was bought by them. And that was Bruce Catton from just before his death in 1978. The book itself was published in 1981. Reflections on the Civil War, and was edited by a fellow named John Leakley. And this is just only the first part of the book. It's a very, very interesting book. My sister gave it to me. And now I'd like to read something by Catherine Q. Cellier, Celebrating Secession Without the Slaves. And these articles are more than coincident to each other, the one by Catton, the chapter, and this article, which was originally published in the New York Times last November. Atlanta. The Civil War, the most wrenching and bloody episode in American history, may not seem like much of a cause for celebration, especially in the South. And yet, as the 150th anniversary of the four-year conflict gets underway, some groups in the old Confederacy are planning at least a certain amount of hoopla, chiefly around the glory days of secession, when 11 states declared their sovereignty under a banner of states' rights and broke from the Union. The events include a secession ball in the former slave port of Charleston, a joyous night of music, dancing, food, and drink, said the invitation, which will be replicated on a smaller scale in other cities of the South, and a parade in Montgomery, Alabama, along with a mock swearing-in of Jefferson Davis as president of the Confederacy. In addition, the Sons of Confederate Veterans and some of its local chapters are preparing various television commercials. All we wanted was to be left alone to govern ourselves, says one ad from the group's Georgia division. That some, even now, are honoring secession with barely a nod to the role of slavery underscores how divisive a topic the war remains, with Americans continuing to debate its causes, its meaning, and its legacy. We in the South, who have been kicked around for an awfully long time and are accused of being racist, we would just like the truth to be known, said Michael Givens, commander-in-chief of the Sons of the Confederacy, explaining the reason for the television ads. While there are many causes of the war, he said, our people were only fighting to protect themselves from an invasion and for their independence. Not everyone is on board with this program, of course. The NAACP, for one, plans to protest these events, saying that celebrating secession is tantamount to celebrating slavery. I can only imagine what kind of celebration they would have if they had won, said Lonnie Randolph, president of the South Carolina NAACP. He said he was dumbfounded by all this glamorization and sanitization of what really happened. When Southerners refer to states' rights, he said, they are really talking about their idea of one right, to buy and sell human beings. The secession events are among hundreds, if not thousands, that will unfold over the next 4 years in honor of the Civil War's sesquicentennial. From Fort Sumter to Appomattox, historic sites across the South and some in the North plan to highlight various aspects of America's deadliest conflict and perhaps its least resolved. Many of the activities are purely historical, and some, like a gathering in November, last November when this article was written, in Gettysburg for the 147th anniversary of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, will be solemn. At Antietam, the annual memorial features 23,000 candles representing that battle's casualties. And the 150th anniversary will be next September in 2012. Some cities and states are promoting their Civil War history with an eye toward attracting tourists. In Atlanta, the Cyclorama, a giant painting in the round that depicts the first day of the Battle of Atlanta, has been refreshed and rebranded, and that's a quote, as part of an overall marketing plan, says Camille Love, the city's director of cultural affairs. Commemorating the Civil War has never been easy. The centennial, 50 years ago, coincided with the Civil Rights Movement, and most of the South was still effectively segregated, making a mockery of any notion that the slaves had truly become free and equal. Congress had designated an official centennial commission, which lost credibility when it planned to meet in a segregated hotel. Last year, Congress was not bothered with an official commission and any master narrative of the war for this 150th anniversary seems elusive. We don't know what to commemorate because we've never faced up to the implications of what the thing was really about, said Andrew Young, a veteran of the Civil Rights Movement and former mayor of Atlanta, Georgia. The easy answer for black folk is that it sets us free, that it set us free, but it really didn't, Mr. Young added. We had another 100 years of segregation. We've never had our complete reconciliation of the forces that divide us. The passion that the Civil War still evokes was evident in early 2010, when Governor Bob McDonnell of Virginia designated April 2010 as Confederate History Month, without mentioning slavery. After a national outcry, he apologized and changed his proclamation to condemn slavery and spell out that slavery had led to war. The proclamation was urged on him by the Sons of Confederate Veterans, which asserts that the Confederacy was a crusade for small government and states' rights. The sesquicentennial, which coincides now with the rise of the Tea Party movement, is providing a new chance for adherents to promote that view. Jeff Antley, a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans and the Confederate Heritage Trust, organized the Secession Ball in Charleston and a 10-day reenactment of the Confederate encampment at Fort Sumter, where the first shots of the war were fired on April 12, 1861, which that day was Astoria, Oregon's 50th anniversary. He said these events were not about modern politics, but were meant to honor those South Carolinians who signed the state's Ordinance of Secession on December 20, 1860, when it became the first state to dissolve its union with the United States. We are celebrating that those 170 people risked their lives and fortunes to stand for what they believed in, which is self-government, Mr. Antley said. Many people in the South still believe that is a just and honorable cause. Do I believe they were right in what they did? Absolutely, he said, noting that he spoke for himself and not any organization. There is no shame or regret over the action those men took. Mr. Antley said he was not defending slavery, which he called an abomination, but defending the South's right to secede, the soldiers' right to defend their homes, and the right to self-government doesn't mean your arguments are without weight because of slavery, he said. Most historians say it is impossible to carve out slavery from the context of the war. As James W. Lewin, a liberal sociologist and author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, put it, the North did not go to war to end slavery. It went to war to hold the country together, and only gradually did it become anti-slavery. But slavery is why the South seceded. In its secession papers, Mississippi, for example, called slavery the greatest material interest of the world, and that's a quote, and said that attempts to stop it would undermine commerce and civilization, again a quote. The conflict has been playing out in recent decades in disputes over the stories told or not told in museum exhibits and on battlefield plaques. These battles of memory are not only academic, said Mark Potok, the director of intelligence at the Southern Poverty Law Center. They are really about present-day attitudes. I don't think the neo-Confederate movement is growing, but it's gotten a new shot of life because of the sesquicentennial. And that was Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And that was an article by Kathleen Q. Seeley for the New York Times, celebrating secession without the slaves. And to sort of wind it up a little bit, early combat hits front lines 150 years later. This is an article by Matthew Barakat from the Associated Press. The list of battles is daunting even for the most fervent Civil War enthusiast. Bull Run, Shiloh, the 7 days battles at Richmond, Second Bull Run, Antietam, Gettysburg, Vicksburg, Appomattox, and many more in between. So when reenactor Troy Fallon surveys the lineup of events marking the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, it is with both excitement and apprehension, especially since event organizers are condensing the historical calendar. Fearing that they'll only get one chance to make the most of the sesquicentennial fever, some historic sites are conducting reenactment this year rather than waiting. The result is a packed lineup of full-blown events from Fort Sumter's opening guns in April 1861 to commemorations of the Confederate surrender at Appomattox in April 1865, all hitting this year. It's going to be a lot of picking and choosing, said Fallon, a 44-year-old in a mock Confederate regiment of the Army of Northern Virginia. Trying to do too much too soon, Fallon said, will lead to burnout among participants and those watching, especially if events are poorly planned. Reenactors in particular are sensitive to the quality of the commemorations, given the amount of time and money they invest. If the events aren't engaging for reenactors and spectators, Fallon said, it's going to turn people off. The anniversary opened with hundreds of people gathered before dawn, April 12th, in Charleston, South Carolina, as some 30 cannons thumped in a reenactment of the Confederate barrage on a federal fort that launched the war 150 years ago. But after 2 or 3 years of large-scale commemorations and hoopla, of battles large and small, will the public still be interested in anniversary events occurring in 2014 and 2015? It's a very real concern, said Karen Hedelt, a tourism official in Fredericksburg, Virginia, about an hour's drive south of Washington. That region was home to several key battles late in the war. In Fredericksburg, sponsors have been staging annual reenactments they hope will let them take advantage of the initial enthusiasm and build up to the flagship commemorations in 2014. I worry we could be calling on all these people too heavily, Hedelt said of the reenactors. And this is Michael McCusker reenacting the Civil War, at least this program. I'll see you next Thursday.